Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident. This is episode 134 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing our rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 exam with a focus on internal medicine. So what if you get a question about a patient, you know, that had like a recent MI? And then they tell you, so let's say this person had the MI like 12 hours ago. And then they tell you that the patient suddenly becomes unresponsive and dies. What's the likely cause of death in that patient? I hope you're saying VFib, right? Remember, VFib is one of the most, is essentially the most common cause of death in the first 24 hours after an MI. Okay, that's something high yield that the MBA may expect you to know. And if a person has VFib, how do you treat VFib? What do you do first? What's always your first step? You would want to go ahead and start chest compressions, right? You want to go ahead and, if you're essentially following your ACLS algorithms, you'd want to go ahead and start chest compressions. And then after starting the chest compressions, the next thing you want to do is you'd want to proceed with trying to defibrillate the patient, right? Remember, defibrillation is the option that you explore for two arrhythmias only, right? One is VFib, and the other is a person that has VTAC with no pulse, okay? So pulseless VTAC, okay? Under those circumstances, you consider defibrillation. Remember, another name for defibrillation is unsynchronized cardioversion. And then you can then begin to mix and match things like giving like a mixture of like epinephrine, like every 4 minutes, and then you give amiodarone, right? So it's like epinephrine, and then you give amiodarone, and then after the amiodarone, you give epinephrine again. And remember, right, amiodarone is a class three antiarrhythmic, right? It's a potassium channel blocker. And remember, there are essentially two uses classically for epinephrine on MBME exams. You can use it for arrhythmias, like again, like basically for ACLS, like asystole, you can use epinephrine for that. PEA, you can use epinephrine for that. VFib, pulseless VTAC, you can use epinephrine for those, right? But remember that epinephrine is also the drug of choice in the treatment of anaphylactic shock, okay? Now, what if you get a question about a patient that, you know, they tell you that this patient had like a recent MI, and then this patient has bilateral crackles when you're trying to like auscultate the lungs, and the person is profoundly hypotensive. What kind of shock is this person in? I would hope you're saying like a cardiogenic shock, right? So if a person has an MI, right, they're gonna have death of their cardiac myocytes. And if those cardiac myocytes die, right, they would not have adequate contractility, right? So they can go into like florid heart failure, right? So they will go into essentially a cardiogenic shock. So the thing is, again, on the MBME, you just don't want to like, because again, right, this scenario I brought up is an easy enough scenario, right? But the thing is, the MBME, I think of it as a derivative test. If any of you have some kind of like investment background, you understand what I mean by a derivative. I used to do investments back in the day, but that's a different story. But the MBME is a derivative test. And if you're thinking about derivatives, right, they would not necessarily ask you about cardiogenic shock. Right, cardiogenic shock is what's going on, but they will ask you some concepts that are related to cardiogenic shock, right? So, for example, they could easily make up like 20 different questions about this. I mean, let me run through a few scenarios, right? So, they could ask you things about like end-diastolic and all that, end-diastolic volumes, end-systolic volumes, or end-systolic pressures and all those things in cardiogenic shock, right? Obviously, if a person has cardiogenic shock, right, the heart will be full with blood, right, because things are backing up. So the end-diastolic volume will be elevated, right? And if the end-diastolic volume is elevated, the end-diastolic pressure will be elevated as well, right? And if a person has cardiogenic shock, right, they would have a decreased ability to send blood forward out of the heart, right? So their stroke volumes will be decreased. And if their stroke volumes are decreased, right, that would also tell you that their systolic blood pressures should be decreased, right? And if their systolic blood pressures are decreased, right, again, you're essentially thinking that, okay, these people have a decreased cardiac output, right? And since these people are sending out less blood with each contraction of the left ventricle, their end systolic volumes are also increased. Remember, the difference between your end diastolic volume and your stroke volume is your end systolic volume. So if your end systolic volume goes down, if your stroke volume goes down, then your end-systolic volume should go up. Okay, again, these are all hemodynamic parameters you want to know with cardiogenic shock. And if you think about it in cardiogenic shock, right, again, if the heart is not pumping blood forward out of the left ventricle, right, you have backup of blood in the left atrium, right? And if you're having backup of blood in the left atrium, what will be true of your left atrial pressures? It'll be elevated, right? Remember, your left atrial pressures are a surrogate for your pulmonary capillary wedge pressures, right? So if a person has cardiogenic shock, their left atrial pressures will be, they will have elevated left atrial pressures. They will have an elevated pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, okay? And this person, I am explaining that this person has like crackles when you auscultate the lungs, right? So obviously this person has a pulmonary edema, right? But the thing is, this person has a pulmonary edema from a cardiogenic source, okay? They have a cardiogenic pulmonary edema, right? Cardiogenic pulmonary edemas tend to be associated with elevated pulmonary capillary wedge pressures. Contrast that with a situation like ARDS, where people have pulmonary edema because they have increased the vascular permeability. That is an example of a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. So under those circumstances, those people's left atrial pressures will actually be normal, right? So one classic telltale finding on MBMEs of ARDS is that the person's pulmonary capillary wedge pressure is less than the magic number 18, okay? Again, because it's a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. So what are some other things that can cause pulmonary edema in a person that recently has an MI, right? You want to think about things like a mitral, like flash mitral regurg, right? If they have like a papillary muscle rupture, for example, right? Because again, if you rupture your papillary muscles as the heart is contracting, those people will have like, essentially like just florid backflow of blood from the left ventricle to the left atrium, and then obviously to the pulmonary veins and then to the lungs, right? So they'll have a pulmonary edema with that. And then remember that people can also have like an interventricular septal rupture as well in the setting of a recent MI. They will likely describe that as a person that recently had an MI, and then the person has a holosystolic murmur that's heard best at the left sternal border. Okay, if you see those kinds of situations, think about an interventricular septal rupture. Right. And then your friends at the MBME can also give you a question about a person that, again, has a recent MI. And then they tell you that this person starts complaining of severe abdominal pain. And they tell you that when you palpate the abdomen, like the person like screams out in like just ridiculous amounts of pain, blah, blah, blah. If you see those kinds of scenarios, I would hope you're thinking about like an acute mesenteric ischemia. Okay. Remember, when a person has an MI, right, the heart doesn't work as well as it should. If the heart doesn't work as well as it should, right, the heart is almost like quivering, it's not contracting appropriately, right? So those people can form clot, right? And that clot can cause an acute ischemia of some organ in the body, like the bowel, right? Especially like if you send off that clot, it flicks off in an embolic phenomenon and goes and occludes the superior mesenteric artery. Remember, the superior mesenteric artery is the most commonly occluded vessel in acute mesenteric ischemia. So those people will have occlusion of the SMA, right? And they can have an acute mesenteric ischemia from that. Similar presentation can also be, again, recent MI, severe acute onset leg pain, right? I would hope you're thinking about acute limb ischemia. Are you seeing that this is essentially the same concept? You're just substituting out the middle letter. Oh, if it's the bowel, it's mesenteric ischemia. Oh, if it's the limb, it's limb ischemia, okay? Acute mesenteric ischemia, acute limb ischemia, right? Those things classically arise in people, at least on MBMEs, in people that have like some condition that makes them form clot in the heart, right? So like in the left atrium, like if a person has a recent MI, another classic one on exams is a person that has a history of AFib, okay? So those are things you want to keep in mind, right? And, right, there are ways you do not confuse acute limb ischemia or acute mesenteric ischemia with the more chronic forms of those diseases, right? So like a chronic mesenteric ischemia, for example, will not be a problem that has an acute onset, right? It'll be something more along the lines of, oh, this person, anytime they eat, they have severe abdominal pain, and it gets better when, like a few hours after eating, right? If you see that, because think about it, if you eat, you're working out your abdominal muscles, right? You need to use your abdominal muscles to digest food and all that stuff. So if you have ischemia, right, your muscles are working more when you eat, your abdominal muscles are working more. So there'll be more need for oxygen and blood and everything, like adequate blood supply to your bowel, right? So under those conditions, it's almost like angina of the heart. This is just more like angina of the bowel, Okay, so if a person has angina of the bowel, right? When because people that have like stable angina, when they rest, they don't have any chest pain. But when they start exercising, they have chest pain. Because when they start exercising, they place more demand on their cardiac myocytes. So they then begin to have like activity-induced ischemia. That's kind of like the same thing with chronic mesenteric ischemia. The person has activity-induced, basically eating. So activity-induced bowel ischemia, okay? So those are things you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. Chronic limb ischemia is essentially peripheral arterial disease, right? Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has like, you know, had a recent MI, and then this person's blood pressure is like 80 over 50, the person has like JVD, and then they show you an EKG, and you notice that you have a tall QRS complex, and then one that's really tiny. Tall QRS complex, one that's really tiny. If you're seeing that in succession, what are you thinking about? I would hope you're thinking about like a ventricular free wall rupture, right? Remember, a ventricular free wall rupture can cause cardiac tamponade, right? Because if the ventricular free wall ruptures, all that blood will essentially pool in the pericardium, right? And that can squish the heart. So they can give you like a Beck's triad presentation in a patient that is recently post-MI. If you ever see something like that, then I really want you to think about a ventricular free wall rupture. And again, it tends to happen a few days after a person has an MI, right? And one thing I will just go ahead and say here is, if a person had their recent MI, you don't want to put those people on steroids for it. I mean, if it's obviously something that they really, really need, fine. But in general, putting a person on steroids is not a great idea, right? In the setting of a recent MI, because that can impair like wound healing, right? And that can essentially make it harder for them to recover from the myocardial infarction, right? So again, ventricular free wall rupture can present as cardiac tamponade, and you have the triad of like the JVD, muffled heart sounds, and the hypotension, right? And one thing I want you to keep at the back of your mind, right, is that again, there are many things the MBME can use to tell you that a person has muffled heart sounds. They can make your life easy and say, oh, the heart sounds are distant on auscultation, right? But they rarely do that. Other things they can do is they can give you like electrical alternance. Remember, electrical alternance is a surrogate for a person's heart essentially dancing in some kind of fluid, like in the setting of a cardiac tamponade, right? So those people under those circumstances, right, like because their heart is dancing in fluid, whenever the heart comes close to the chest wall, right, the EKG will record a strong signal. They'll get a big, nice, fat QRS complex. But when the heart dances away in the fluid, away from the chest wall, right, they will have a decreased amplitude of the QRS complex because the EKG lead will capture less in the way of electrical activity, right? And then, so electrical alternance is one surrogate. Another surrogate they can just give you is like a low voltage QR, like a low voltage EKG, right? Again, if a person has a low voltage EKG, that means that the person's heart, like the EKG leads are not capturing enough. So because they're not capturing enough electrical activity because there is something in the way between the ventricles, right, and the EKG leads, right? Like fluid, for example. Or it could be like fibrosis or like deposition of like some substance like amyloid, for example. Those conditions are all associated with low voltage EKGs. So those are high yield things to keep in mind. And then remember, if a person has like, again, like an MI and they have this cardiogenic shock, what should be true of their systemic vascular resistance? It should be decreased, right? They should have it should be increased, because think about it. If a person has a decreased cardiac output because they have cardiogenic shock, right, those people's blood pressures go down. If their blood pressures go down, then the body says, like the body says, I need to maintain blood pressures, right? So the way your body will choose to maintain those blood pressures, right, to keep like your perfusion going, is that your blood pressure, body will go into like extreme vasoconstriction, and that would increase the systemic vascular resistance, okay? Now, what happens to the central venous pressure if a person has cardiogenic shock? The central venous pressure should go up, right? Again, remember, the central venous pressure is a surrogate for right atrial pressure. Okay, contrast that with the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, that is a surrogate for left atrial pressure, right? So if a person has cardiogenic shock, fluid is backing up in the right atrium, right? So the end diastolic volume, if you may, of the right atrium will go up, right? So the end diastolic pressure will go up. So the CVP, the central venous pressure, should go up, right? And again, it should make sense that the right atrial pressure is called CVP, right? Central venous pressure, because where do all the veins of your body, with the exception of the pulmonary veins, drain into? That's the right atrium. Okay, good. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, had like a recent MRI, and then they tell you that this patient, you know, went for revascularization, and then they tell you that this patient starts complaining of chest pain again? What is the best lab marker for this patient if you want to detect reinfarction? I would hope you're thinking about CKMB. Okay, I would hope you're thinking about CKMB, right? Remember, CKMB is the troponin, right? If troponin rises, it sort of takes a while for it to die down, right? So if a person has a reinfarction, you want to go ahead and check the CKMB under those circumstances. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a patient that had had a recent MRI, they got percutaneous or coronary intervention, and then they tell you that this person, the person's creatinine has started rising, and then they tell you that this person, they show you like a picture, like a really gross picture of the person's toes, and you notice that the person's toes are like blue, and the person has like this netted, like almost like mat-like lesion on the lower extremities. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? I would really hope you're thinking about cholesterol embolization syndrome, okay? Cholesterol embolization syndrome. That is something your friends at the MBME love to test a lot, right? So if a person gets PCI or some kind of like vascular procedure that could potentially dislodge cholesterol from a vessel, right? That cholesterol can shoot all around the body. It can begin to cause like embolic phenomena in different organs, right? So classically on MBMEs, it will present as like renal failure. So the person's creatinine will begin to rise. But other things that can happen is it can begin to, those cholesterol crystals can begin to embolize like vessels in your distal extremities, right? So it can cause something called like a blue toe syndrome. Or those people can have like the net-like skin finding on the distal extremities that I was talking about is a livido reticularis, okay? Those are all things that can pop up in exams in this setting. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has a recent MI, and then they tell you that this patient is complaining of chest pain, and then they tell you that when you listen to the chest, you hear like a scratchy sound in systole and in diastole? What are you thinking about? I would hope you're thinking about like a post-infarction pericarditis, right? Remember, people after an MI, they can have a pericarditis that happens like a few days after the MI or a few weeks after the MI, right? So the one that comes up a few days afterwards is the post-infarction, like the fibrinous pericarditis. The one that shows up weeks later, right? That's your Dressler syndrome. Remember, Dressler syndrome arises from an autoimmune phenomenon. Okay, right? And again, I'm essentially describing pericarditis, right? So like chest pain, worsened when you lie back, better when you lean forward, right? And on an EKG, right? I would really hope that you remember that those people can have ST elevations everywhere, right? Remember, normally, if you have ST elevations, it should be in a territorial distribution. But if you're having ST elevations everywhere, it doesn't seem to be obeying any vascular territory, then under those circumstances, you want to really think about pericarditis, right? And then also remember that pericarditis can also be associated with like PR segment depression on an EKG, right? And then some other high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind with a pericarditis, right, is there's many other things that can cause pericarditis, right? So they can give you a person that had like a recent like viral upper respiratory infection, and then they have like the classic pericarditis symptoms, right? Viral URIs can cause pericarditis. In fact, they are probably the most common cause of pericarditis in the US, right? Now, other things that can cause pericarditis, they can give you a person that has renal failure, right? Renal failure, those people can have uremia can cause a pericarditis, right? Another thing that can cause pericarditis is if a person has like radiation therapy to the chest, right? They can classically give it to you in a person that, for example, has a history of like breast cancer and they got radiation and then they are complaining of chest pain, or a person that has like a lymphoma and they got radiation to the chest, right? And then they're complaining of chest pain, right? If you see those kinds of scenarios, think about pericarditis being the inciting cause, right? And then some other things they could also test with that, right? Remember, if a person gets radiation to the chest wall, that increases their risk of what? that increases your risk of thyroid cancer, right? Especially papillary thyroid cancer. Remember, the biggest risk factor for thyroid cancer is a prior history of exposure to radiation for the chest, the neck, the head, okay? Those are high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, they come in with chest pain radiating to the jaw, so classic MI symptoms. And then for the person's chest pain, you give them nitroglycerin, and then the patient suddenly becomes unresponsive. What are you thinking about? I would really, really hope you're thinking about a patient having an RC infarct, right? So like ST elevations in like 2-3 EVF, right? So why did the patient become unresponsive after you give them nitro for their chest pain? It's a right-sided infarction, right? Remember, people that have right-sided infarcts, they are very, very preload dependent. So if you give them nitroglycerin for like their chest pain, remember, nitroglycerin is a venodilator, right? So that would decrease preload. If you decrease preload, those people can go into almost like a low volume shock, like real quick, right? And then they can die. They can die relatively quickly. So before you start throwing out drugs for a person that has an MI, you better make sure you've looked at the EKG. If not, you can get into trouble relatively quickly under those circumstances. The way you actually treat right-sided MIs is to give the person fluids, right? Just to keep their preload up. Okay, now, what if you get a question about a patient that... this doesn't necessarily relate to, the scenario I'm thinking of in my head doesn't really relate to an MI. So, okay, I guess I'm going to maybe go ahead and stop here. This other topic, it should best make its way to another podcast. So I'll talk about it in another podcast. Really, in this podcast, I just really wanted to hit the complications of an MI really hard, because MIs are things you're going to see on your NBME exams. You're going to see on your Step 2 CK exam. And as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, right? So step 1, 2CK, 2CS, step 3, the preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. If you're an internal medicine resident, I do tutor for like the ABIM board exams, right? And the in-training exams. And then like college students, I tutor essentially every pre-med subject. And then I do offer like one-on-one advising, or like, I guess, consultant for like ERAS applications, AMCAS applications. So if you're like a med student applying to residency, I'm currently working with a ton of people in that process with ERAS coming out next month. So if you need advising for any of those things, don't be afraid to reach out to me, and I'll be more than happy to point you in the right direction. I do it on a one-on-one basis. So either reach out to me through the website or send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I will see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.